At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
The Moon Metal, Chapter 9. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. The Moon Metal by Garrett P. Service. Chapter 9. The Detective of Science. The morning of my arrival at Grand Teton Station, on my return from the East, Andrew Hall met me with a warm greeting. "I have been anxiously expecting you," he said, "for I have made some progress toward solving the great mystery. I have not yet reached a conclusion, but I hope soon to let you into the entire secret. In the meantime, you can aid me with your companionship, if in no other way, for since the defeat of the mob, this place has been mighty lonesome. The Grand Teton is a spot that people who have no particular business out here carefully avoid. I am on speaking terms with Dr. Six, and occasionally, when there is a party to be shown around, I visit his works and make the best possible use of my eyes. Captain Carter of the military is a capital fellow, and I like to hear his stories of the war in Luzon 40 years ago, but I want somebody to whom I can occasionally confide things, and so you are as welcome as moonlight in harvest time. Tell me something about the wonderful fight with the mob. Did you see it?" "I did. I had got wind of what Bings intended to do while I was down at Pocatello, and I hurried up here to warn the soldiers, but unfortunately I came too late. Finding the military cooped up in the guardhouse and the mob masters of the situation, I kept out of sight on the side of the Teton and watched the siege with my binocular. I think there was very little of the spectacle that I missed." "What of the mysterious force that the doctor employed to sweep off the assailants?" "Of course, Captain Carter's suggestion that Six turned molten artemisium from his furnace into a hosepipe and sprayed the enemy with it is ridiculous, but it is much easier to dismiss Carter's theory than to substitute a better one. I saw the doctor on the roof with a gang of black workmen, and I noticed the flash of polished metal turned rapidly this way and that, but there was some intervening obstacle which prevented me from getting a good view of the mechanism employed. It certainly bore no resemblance to a hosepipe, or anything of that kind. No emanation was visible from the machine, but it was stupefying to see the mob melt down." "How about the coating of the bodies with artemisium?" "There you are, back on the hosepipe again," laughed Hall. "But to tell you the truth, I'd rather be excused from expressing an opinion on that operation in wholesale electroplating just at present. I've the ghost of an idea what it means, but let me test my theory a little before I formulate it. In the meanwhile, won't you take a stroll with me?" "Certainly, nothing would please me better," I replied. "Which way shall we go?" "To the top of the Grand Teton." "What? Are you seized with the mountain-climbing fever?" "Not exactly, but I have a particular reason for wishing to take a look from that pinnacle." "I suppose you know the real apex of the peak has never been trodden by man." "I do know it. But it is just that apex that I am determined to have under my feet for 10 minutes. The failure of others is no argument for us." "Just as you say," I rejoined, "but I suppose there is no indiscretion in asking whether this little climb has any relation to the mystery." "If it didn't have an important relation to the clearing up of that dark thing, I wouldn't risk my neck in such an undertaking," was the reply. Accordingly, the next morning, we set out for the peak. All previous climbers, as we were aware, had attacked it from the west. That seemed the obvious thing to do, because the westward slopes of the mountain, while very steep, are less abrupt than those which face the rising sun. In fact, The eastern side of the Grand Teton appears to be absolutely unclimbable. But both Hall and I had had experience with rock climbing in the Alps and the Dolomites, and we knew that what looked like the hardest places sometimes turn out to be next to the easiest. Accordingly, we decided, the more particularly because it would save time, but also because we yielded to the common desire to outdo our predecessors, to try to scale the giant right up his face. We carried a very light but exceedingly strong rope, about 500 feet long, wore nail-shod shoes, and had each a metal-pointed staff and a small hatchet in lieu of the regular mountaineer's axe. Advancing at first along the broken ridge between two gorges, we gradually approached the steeper part of the Teton, where the cliffs looked so sheer and smooth that it seemed no wonder that nobody had ever tried to scale them. The air was deliciously clear, and the sky wonderfully blue above the mountains, and the moon, a few days past its last quarter, was visible in the southwest, its pale crescent face slightly blued by the atmosphere, as it always appears when seen in daylight. "Slow westering a phantom sail, the lonely soul of yesterday." Behind us, somewhat north of east, lay the Six Works, with their black smoke rising almost vertically in the still air. Suddenly, as we stumbled along on the rough surface, something whizzed past my face and fell on the rock at my feet. I looked at the strange missile that had come like a meteor out of open space with astonishment. It was a bird, a beautiful specimen of the scarlet tanagers, which I remembered the early explorers had found inhabiting the Teton canyons, their brilliant plumage borrowing splendor from contrast with the gloomy surroundings. It lay motionless, its outstretched wings having a curious shriveled aspect, while the flaming color of the breast was half obliterated with smutty patches. Stooping to pick it up, I noticed a slight bronzing, which instantly recalled to my mind the peculiar appearance of the victims of the attack on the mine. "Look here," I called to Hall, who was several yards in advance. He turned, and I held up the bird by a wing. "Where did you get that?" he asked. "It fell at my feet a moment ago." Hall glanced in a startled manner at the sky, and then down the slope of the mountain. "Did you notice in what direction it was flying?" he asked. "No, it dropped so close that it almost grazed my nose. I saw nothing of it until it made me blink." "I have been heedless," muttered Hall under his breath. At the time I did not notice the singularity of his remark, my attention being absorbed in contemplating the unfortunate tanager. "Look how its feathers are scorched," I said. "I know it," Hall replied without glancing at the bird. "And it is covered with a film of artemisium," I added, a little piqued by his abstraction. "I know that too." "See here, Hall," I exclaimed, "are you trying to make game of me?" "Not at all, my dear fellow," he replied, dropping his cogitation. "Pray forgive me, but this is no new phenomenon to me. I have picked up birds in that condition on this mountain before. There is a terrible mystery here, but I am slowly letting light into it, and if we succeed in reaching the top of the peak, I have good hope that the illumination will increase." "Here now," he added a moment later, sitting down upon a rock and thrusting the blade of his penknife into a crevice, "what do you think of this?" He held up a little nugget of pure artemisium and then went on. "You know that all this slope was swept as clean as a Dutch housewife's kitchen floor by the thousands of miners and prospectors who swarmed over it a year or two ago, and do you suppose they would have missed such a tidbit if it had been here then?" "Dr. Six must have been salting the mountain again," I suggested. "Well," replied Hall, with a significant smile, "if the doctor hasn't salted it, somebody else has. That's plain enough. But perhaps you would like to know precisely what I expect to find out when we get on the topknot of the Teton." "I should certainly be delighted to learn the object of our journey," I said. "Of course, I'm only going along for company, and for the fun of the thing. But you know you can count on me for substantial aid whenever you need it." "It is because you are so willing to let me keep my own counsel," he rejoined, "and to wait for things to ripen before compelling me to disclose them, that I like to have you with me at critical times. Now, as to the object of this breakneck expedition, whose risks you understand as fully as I do, I need not assure you that it is of supreme importance to the success of my plans. In a word, I hope to be able to look down into a part of Dr. Six's mill, which, if I am not mistaken, no human eye except his and those of his most trustworthy helpers has ever been permitted to see. And if I see there what I fully expect to see, I shall have got a long step nearer to a great fortune." "Good!" I cried. "En avant, then! We are losing time." End of chapter 9. This recording is in the public domain. The Moon Metal, Chapter 10. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush, in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. The Moon Metal, by Garrett P. Service. Chapter 10. The Top of the Grand Teton. The climbing soon became difficult, until at length we were going up hand over hand, taking advantage of crevices and knobs which an inexperienced eye would have regarded as incapable of affording a grip for the fingers or a support for the toes. Presently we arrived at the foot of a stupendous precipice, which was absolutely insurmountable by any ordinary method of ascent. Parts of it overhung, and everywhere the face of the rock was too free from irregularities to afford any footing except to a fly. "Now, to borrow the expression of old Bunyan, we are hard put to it," I remarked. "If you will go to the left, I will take the right and see if there is any chance of getting up." "I don't believe we could find any place easier than this," Hall replied, "and so we go up where we are." "Have you a pair of wings concealed about you?" I asked, laughing at his folly. "Well, something nearly as good," he responded, unstrapping his knapsack. He produced a silken bag, which he unfolded on the rock. "A balloon!" I exclaimed. "But how are you going to inflate it?" For reply, Hall showed me a receptacle which he said contained liquid hydrogen, and which was furnished with a device for retarding the volatilization of the liquid so that it could be carried with little loss. "You remember, I have a small laboratory in the abandoned mine," he explained, "where we used to manufacture liquid air for blasting. This balloon I made for our present purpose. It will just suffice to carry up our rope, and a small but practically unbreakable grapple of hardened gold. I calculate to send the grapple to the top of the precipice with the balloon, and when it has obtained a firm hold in the riven rock, there we can ascend, sailor fashion. You see, the rope has knots, and I know your muscles are as trustworthy in such work as my own." There was a slight breeze from the eastward, and the current of air slanting up the face of the peak assisted the balloon in mounting with its burden, and favored us by promptly swinging the little airship, with a grapple swaying beneath it, over the brow of the cliff onto the atmospheric eddy above. As soon as we saw that the grapple was well over the edge, we pulled upon the rope. The balloon instantly shot into view with the anchor dancing, but under the influence of the wind, quickly returned to its former position behind the projecting brink. The grapple had failed to take hold. "Try again must be our motto now," muttered Hall. We tried several times with the same result, although each time we slightly shifted our position. At last the grapple caught. "Now all together," cried my companion, and simultaneously we threw our weight upon the slender rope. The anchor apparently did not give an inch. "Let me go first," said Hall, pushing me aside as I caught the first knot above my head. "It's my device, and it's only fair that I should have the first try." In a minute he was many feet up the wall, climbing swiftly hand over hand, but occasionally stopping and twisting his leg around the rope while he took breath. "It's easier than I expected," he called down, when he had ascended about 100 feet. "Here and there the rock offers a little hold for the knees." I watched him, breathless with anxiety, and as he got higher, my imagination pictured the little gold grapple, invisible above the brow of the precipice, with perhaps a single thin prong wedged into a crevice, and slowly ploughing its way towards the edge with each impulse of the climber, until but another pull was needed to set it flying. So vivid was my fancy that I tried to banish it by noticing that a certain knot in the rope remained just at the level of my eyes, where it had been from the start. Hall was now fully 200 feet above the ledge on which I stood, and was rapidly nearing the top of the precipice. In a minute more he would be safe. Suddenly he shouted, and glancing up with a leap of my heart, I saw that he was falling. He kept his face to the rock, and came down feet foremost. I would not go through that experience again for the price of a battleship. Yet it lasted less than a second. He had dropped not more than 10 feet when the fall was arrested. "All right," he called cheerily. "No harm done. It was only a slip." But what a slip! If the balloon had not carried the anchor several yards back from the edge, it would have had no opportunity to catch another hold as it shot forward. And how could we know that the second hold would prove more secure than the first? Hall did not hesitate, however, for one instant. Up he went again. But in fact, his best chance was in going up, for he was within 4 yards of the top when the mishap occurred. With a sigh of relief, I saw him at last throw his arm over the verge and then wriggle his body upon the ledge. A few minutes later, he was lying on his stomach with his face over the edge, looking down at me. "Come on," he shouted. "It's all right." When I had pulled myself over the brink at his side, I grasped his hand and pressed it without a word. We understood one another. "It was pretty close to a miracle," he remarked at last. "Look at this." The rock over which the grapple had slipped was deeply scored by the unyielding point of the metal, and exactly at the verge of the precipice the prong had wedged itself into a narrow crack, so firmly that we had to chip away the stone in order to release it. If it had slipped a single inch farther before taking hold, it would have been all over with my friend. Such experiences shake the strongest nerves, and we sat on the shelf we had attained for fully a quarter of an hour before we ventured to attack the next precipice, which hung beetling directly above us. It was not as lofty as the one we had just ascended, but it impended to such a degree that we saw we should have to climb our rope while it swung free in the air. Luckily, we had little difficulty in getting a grip for the prongs, and we took every precaution to test the security of the anchorage, not only putting our combined weight repeatedly upon the rope, but flipping and jerking it with all our strength. The grapple resisted every effort to dislodge it, and finally I started up, insisting on my turn as leader. The height I had to ascend did not exceed 100 feet, but that is a very great distance to climb on a swinging rope, without a wall within reach to assist by its friction and occasional friendly projections. In a little while my movements, together with the effect of the slight wind, had imparted a most distressing oscillation to the rope. This sometimes carried me with a nerve-shaking bang against a prominent point of the precipice, where I would dislodge loose fragments that kept Hall dodging for his life, and then I would swing out, apparently beyond the brow of the cliff below, so that, as I involuntarily glanced downward, I seemed to be hanging in free space, while the steep mountainside, looking 10 times steeper than it really was, resembled the vertical wall of an absolutely bottomless abyss, as if I were suspended over the edge of the world. I avoided thinking of what the grapple might be about, and in a haste to get through with the awful experience, I worked myself fairly out of breath, so that, when at last I reached the rounded brow of the cliff, I had to stop and cling there for fully a minute before I could summon strength enough to lift myself over it. When I was assured that the grapple was still securely fastened, I signaled to Hall, and he soon stood at my side, exclaiming as he wiped the perspiration from his face, "I think I'll try wings next time." But our difficulties had only begun. As we had foreseen, it was a case of elp above elp, to the very limit of human strength and patience. However, it would have been impossible to go back. In order to descend the two precipices we had surmounted, it would have been necessary to leave our lifelines clinging to the rocks, and we had not rope enough to do that. If we could not reach the top, we were lost. Having refreshed ourselves with a bite to eat and a little stimulant, we resumed the climb. After several hours of the most exhausting work I have ever performed, we pulled our weary limbs upon the narrow ridge, but a few square yards in area, which constitutes the apex of the Grand Teton. A little below, on the opposite side of a steep-walled gap, which divides the top of the mountain into two parts, we saw the singular enclosure of stones which the early white explorers found there, and which they ascribed to the Indians, although nobody has ever known who built it or what purpose it served. The view was, of course, superb, but while I was admiring it in all its wonderful extent and variety, Hall, who had immediately pulled out his binocular, was busy inspecting the six works, the top of whose great tufted smoke column was thousands of feet beneath our level. Jackson's Lake, Jenny's Lake, Lee's Lake, and several lakelets glittered in the sunlight amid the pale grays and greens of Jackson's Hole, while many a bending reach of the Snake River shone amid the wastes of sagebrush and rock. "There!" suddenly exclaimed Hall. "I thought I should find it." "What?" "Take a look through my glass at the roof of Six's Mill. Look just in the center." "Why, it's open in the middle," I cried as soon as I had put the glass to my eyes. "There's a big circular hole in the center of the roof." "Look inside, look inside," repeated Hall impatiently. "I see nothing there except something bright." "Do you call it nothing because it is bright?" "Well, no," I replied, laughing. "What I mean is that I see nothing that I can make anything of, except a shining object, and all I can make of that is that it is bright." "You've been in the six works many times, haven't you?"
"Yes."
"Did you ever see the opening in the roof?"
"Never."
"Did you ever hear of it?"
"Never."
"Then Dr. Six doesn't show his visitors everything that is to be seen."
"Evidently not. As we know, he concealed the double tunnel and the room under the furnace."
"Dr. Six has concealed a bigger secret than that," Hall responded, "and the Grand Teton has helped me to a glimpse of it." For several minutes my friend was absorbed in thought. Then he broke out, "I tell you, he's the most wonderful man in the world."
"Who, Dr. Six?"
"Well, I've long thought that."
"Yes, but I mean in a different way from what you are thinking of. Do you remember my asking you once if you believed in alchemy?"
"I remember being greatly surprised by your question to that effect."
"Well, now," said Hall, rubbing his hands with a satisfied air, while his eyes glanced keen and bright with the reflection of some passing thought, "Max Six is greater than any alchemist that ever lived. If those old guys in the Dark Ages had accomplished everything they set out to do, they would have been of no more consequence in comparison with our black-browed friend down yonder there than my head is of consequence in comparison with the moon."
"I fear you flatter the man in the moon," was my laughing reply.
"No, I don't," returned Hall, "and some day you'll admit it."
"Well, what about that something that shines down there? You seem to see more in it than I can." But my companion had fallen into a reverie and didn't hear my question. He was gazing abstractedly at the faint image of the waning moon, now nearing the distant mountaintop over in Idaho. Presently his mind seemed to return to the old magnet, and he whirled about and glanced down at the Six Mill. The column of smoke was diminishing in volume, an indication that the engine was about to enjoy one of its periodical rests. The irregularity of these stoppages had always been a subject of remark among practical engineers. The hours of labor were exceedingly erratic, but the engine had never been known to work at night, except on one occasion, and then only for a few minutes, when it was suddenly stopped on account of a fire. Just as Hall resumed his inspection, two huge quarter spheres, which had been resting wide apart on the roof, moved towards one another until their arched sections met over the circular aperture, which they covered like the dome of an observatory.
"I expected it," Hall remarked. "But come, it is mid-afternoon, and we shall need all of our time to get safely down before the light fades."
As I have already explained, it would not have been possible for us to return the way we came,
but we determined to descend the comparatively easy western slope of the peak and pass the night on that side of the mountain, letting ourselves down with the rope into the hollow way that divides the summit of the Teton into two pinnacles. We had no difficulty in descending by the route followed by all previous climbers. The weather was fine, and having found good shelter among the rocks, we passed the night in comfort. The next day we succeeded in swinging round upon the eastern flank of the Teton, below the more formidable cliffs, and just at nightfall we arrived at the station. As we passed the sixth mine, the doctor himself confronted us. There was a very displeasing look on his dark countenance, and his sneer was strongly marked.
"So you have been on top of the Teton?" he said.
"Yes," replied Hall, very blandly.
"And if you have a taste for that sort of thing, I should advise you to go up. The view is immense, as fine as the best in the Alps."
"Pretty ingenious plan, that balloon of yours," continued the doctor, still looking black.
"Thank you," Hall replied, more suavely than ever. "I've been planning that a long time. You probably don't know that mountaineering used to be my chief amusement."
The doctor turned away without pursuing the conversation.
"I could kick myself," Hall muttered, as soon as Dr. Six was out of earshot. "If my absurd wish to outdo others had not blinded me, I should have known that he would see us going up this side of the peak, particularly with the balloon to give us away. However, what's done can't be undone. He may not really suspect the truth, and if he does, he can't help himself, even though he is the richest man in the world."
End of chapter 10.
This recording is in the public domain.
The Moon Metal,
Chapter 11.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush, in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. The Moon Metal, by Garrett P. Service.
Chapter 11. Strange Fate of a Kite. "Are you ready for another tramp?" was Andrew Hall's greeting when we met early on the morning following our return from the peak.
"Certainly I am. What is your program for today?"
"I wish to test the flying qualities of a kite which I have constructed since our return last night."
"You don't allow the calls of sleep to interfere very much with your activity."
"I haven't much time for sleep just now," replied Hall, without smiling. "The kite test will carry us up the flanks of the Teton, but I am not going to try for the top this time. If you will come along, I'll ask you to help me by carrying and operating a light transit. I shall carry another myself. I am desirous to get the elevation that the kite attains, and certain other data that will be of use to me. We will make a detour towards the south, for I don't want Old Six's suspicions to be prodded any more."
"What interest can he have in your kite-flying?"
"The same interest that a burglar has in the wrap of a policeman's nightstick."
"Then your experiment today has some connection with the solution of the great mystery?"
"My dear fellow," said Hall, laying his hand on my shoulder, "until I see the end of that mystery I shall think of nothing else." In a few hours we were clambering over the broken rocks on the southeastern flank of the Teton, at an elevation of about 3,000 feet above the level of Jackson's Hole. Finally, Hall paused and began to put his kite together. It was a small boxed-shaped affair, very light in construction, with paper sides.
"In order to diminish the chances of Dr. Six noticing what we are about," he said as he worked away, "I have covered the kite with sky-blue paper. This, together with distance, will probably insure us against his notice."
In a few minutes the kite was ready. Having ascertained the direction of the wind with much attention, he stationed me with my transit on a commanding rock, and sought another post for himself at a distance of 200 yards, which he carefully measured with a gold tape. My instructions were to keep the telescope on the kite as soon as it had attained a considerable height, and to note the angle of elevation and the horizontal angle with the base line joining our points of observation.
"Be particularly careful," was Hall's injunction, "and if anything happens to the kite, by all means note the angles at that instant." As soon as we had fixed our stations, Hall began to pay out the string, and the kite rose very swiftly. As it sped away into the blue, it was soon practically invisible to the naked eye, although the telescope of the transit enabled me to follow it with ease. Glancing across now and then at my companion, I noticed that he was having considerable difficulty in, at the same time, managing the kite and manipulating his transit. But as the kite continued to rise and steadied in position, his task became easier, until at length he ceased to remove his eyes from the telescope while holding the string with outstretched hand. "Don't lose sight of it now for an instant!" he shouted. For at least half an hour he continued to manipulate the string, sending the kite now high towards the zenith with a sudden pull, and then letting it drift off. It seemed at least to become almost a fixed point. Very slowly the angles changed, when suddenly there was a flash, and to my amazement I saw the paper of the kite shrivel and disappear in a momentary flame, and then the bare sticks came tumbling out of the sky. "Did you get the angles?" yelled Hall excitedly. "Yes, the telescope is yet pointed on the spot where the kite disappeared." "Read them off," he called, "and then get your angle with the six works." "All right," I replied, doing as he had requested, and noticing at the same time that he was in the act of putting his watch in his pocket. "Is there anything else?" I asked. "No, that will do, thank you." Hall came running over, his face beaming, and with the air of a man who has just hooked a particularly cunning old trout. "Ah," he exclaimed, "this has been a great success. I could almost dispense with the calculation. But it is best to be sure."
"What are you about, anyhow?" I asked. "And what was it that happened to the kite?"
"Don't interrupt me just now, please," was the only reply I received. Thereupon my friend sat down on a rock, pulled out a pad of paper, noted the angles which I had read on the transit, and fell to figuring with feverish haste. In the course of his work he consulted a pocket almanac, then glanced up at the sky, muttered approvingly, and finally leaped to his feet with a half-suppressed hurrah! If I had not known him so well, I should have thought that he had gone daft.
"Will you kindly tell me," I asked, "how you managed to set the kite afire?"
Hall laughed heartily. "You thought it was a trick, did you?" said he. "Well, it was no trick, but a very beautiful demonstration. You surely haven't forgotten the scarlet tanager that gave you such a surprise the day before yesterday."
"Do you mean," I exclaimed, startled at the suggestion, "that the fate of the bird had any connection with the accident to your kite?"
"Accident isn't precisely the right word," replied Hall. "The two things are as intimately related as own brothers. If you should care to hunt up the kite-sticks, you would find that they, too, are now artemisium-plated."
"This is getting too deep for me," was all that I could say.
"I'm not absolutely confident that I have touched bottom myself," said Hall, "but I'm going to make another dive, and if I don't bring up treasures greater than Vanderdecken found at the bottom of the sea, then Dr. Six is even a more wonderful human mystery than I have thought him to be."
"What do you propose to do next?"
"To shake the dust of the Grand Teton from my shoes and go to San Francisco, where I have an extensive laboratory."
"So you're going to try a little alchemy yourself, are you?"
"Perhaps. Who knows? At any rate, my good friend, I am forever indebted to you for your assistance, and even more for your discretion, and if I succeed, you shall be the first person in the world to hear the news." End of chapter 11.
This recording is in the public domain. The Moon Metal.
Chapter 12.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush, in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. The Moon Metal, by Garrett P. Service.
Chapter 12. Better Than Alchemy. I come now to a part of my narrative which would have been deemed altogether incredible in those closing years of the 19th century that witnessed the first steps towards the solution of the deepest mysteries of the ether,
although men even then held in their hands, without knowing it, powers which, after they had been mastered and before use had made them familiar, seemed no less than godlike. For 6 months after Hall's departure for San Francisco, I heard nothing from him. Notwithstanding my intense desire to know what he was doing, I did not seek to disturb him in his retirement. In the meantime, things ran on as usual in the world, only a ripple being caused by renewed discoveries of small nuggets of artemisium on the Tetons, a fact which recalled to my mind the remark of my friend when he dislodged a flake of the metal from a crevice during our ascent of the peak. At last, one day I received his telegram at my office in New York. San Francisco, May 16, 1940. Come at once. The mystery is solved. Signed, Hall. As soon as I could pack a grip, I was flying westward 100 miles an hour. On reaching San Francisco, which had made enormous strides since the opening of the 20th century, owing to the extension of our Oriental possessions, and which already ranked with New York and Chicago among the financial capitals of the world, I hastened to Hall's laboratory. He was there expecting me, and after a hearty greeting, during which his elation over his success was manifest, he said, "I am compelled to ask you to make a little journey. I found it impossible to secure the necessary privacy here, and before opening my experiments, I selected a site for a new laboratory in an unfrequented spot among the mountains this side of Lake Tahoe. You will be the first man, with the exception of my two devoted assistants, to see my apparatus, and you shall share the sensation of the critical experiment."
"Then you have not yet completed your solution of the secret?"
"Yes, I have, for I am as certain of the result as if I had seen it. But I thought you were entitled to be in with me at the death." From the nearest railway station we took horses to the laboratory, which occupied a secluded but most beautiful site at an elevation of about 6,000 feet above sea level. With considerable surprise, I noticed a building surmounted with a dome, recalling what we had seen from the Grand Teton on the roof of Dr. Six's mill. Hall, observing my look, smiled significantly, but said nothing. The laboratory proper occupied a smaller building adjoining the domed structure. Hall led the way into an apartment, having but a single door and illuminated by a skylight. "This is my sanctum sanctorum," he said, "and you are the first outsider to enter it. Seat yourself comfortably until I proceed to unveil a little corner of the artemisium mystery." Near one end of the room, which was about 30 feet in length, was a table, on which lay a glass tube about 2 inches in diameter and 30 inches long. In the farther end of the tube gleamed a lump of yellow metal, which I took to be gold. Hall and I were seated near another table about 20 feet distant from the tube, and on this table was an apparatus furnished with a concave mirror, whose optical axis was directed towards the tube. It occurred to me at once that this apparatus would be suitable for experimenting with electric waves. Wires ran from it to the floor, and in the cellar beneath was audible the beating of an engine. My companion made an adjustment or two, and then remarked, "Now keep your eye on the lump of gold in the farther end of the tube yonder. The tube is exhausted of air, and I am about to concentrate upon the gold an intense electric influence, which will have the effect of making it a kind of cathode pole. I only use this term for the sake of illustration. You will recall that as long ago as the days of Crookes, it was known that a cathode in an exhausted tube would project particles, or atoms, of its substance away in straight lines. Now watch." I fixed my attention upon the gold, and presently saw it enveloped in a most beautiful violet light. This grew more intense, until at times it was blinding, while at the same moment the interior of the tube seemed to have become charged with a luminous vapor of a delicate pinkish hue. "Watch, watch," said Hall. "Look at the nearer end of the tube." "Why, it is becoming coated with gold," I exclaimed. He smiled, but made no reply. Still, the strange process continued. The pink vapor became so dense that the lump of gold was no longer visible, although the eye of violet light glared piercingly through the colored fog. Every second the deposit of metal shining like a mirror, increased, until suddenly there came a curious whistling sound. Hall, who had been adjusting the mirror, jerked away his hand and gave it a flip, as if hot water had spattered it, and then the light in the tube quickly died away. The vapor escaped, filling the room with a peculiar, stimulating odor, and I perceived that the end of the glass tube had been melted through, and the molten gold was slowly dripping from it. "I carried it a little too far," said Hall, ruefully rubbing the back of his hand, "and when the glass gave way under the atomic bombardment, a few atoms of gold visited my bones. But there is no harm done. You observed that the instant the air reached the cathode, as I for convenience call the electrified mass of gold, the action ceased? But your anode, to continue your simile," I said, "is constantly exposed to the air." "True," he replied, "but in the first place, of course, this is not really an anode, just as the other is not really a cathode. As science advances, we are compelled for a time to use old terms in a new sense, until a fresh nomenclature can be invented. But we are now dealing with a form of electric action more subtle in its effects than any at present described in the textbooks and the transactions of learned societies. I have not yet even attempted to work out the theory of it. I am only concerned with its facts." "But wonderful as the exhibition you have given is, I do not see," I said, "how it concerns Dr. Six and his artemisium." "Listen," replied Hall, settling back in his chair after disconnecting his apparatus. "You no doubt have been told how one night the Six engine was heard working for a few minutes, the first and only night work it was ever known to have done, and how, hardly had it started up when a fire broke out in the mill, and the engine was instantly stopped. Now there is a very remarkable story connected with that, and it will show you how I got my first clue to the mystery, although it was rather a mere suspicion than a clue, for at first I could make nothing of it. The alleged fire occurred about a fortnight after our discovery of the double tunnel. My mind was then full of suspicions concerning Six, because I thought that a man who would fool people with one hand was not likely to deal fairly with the other. It was a glorious night, with a full moon, whose face was so clear in the limpid air that, having found a snug place at the foot of a yellow pine tree, where the ground was carpeted with odoriferous needles, I lay on my back and renewed my early acquaintance with the romantically named mountains and seas of the lunar globe. With my binocular I could trace those long white streaks which radiate from the crater ring called Tycho, and run hundreds of miles in all directions over the moon. As I gazed at these singular objects, I recalled the various theories which astronomers, puzzled by their enigmatical aspect, have offered to a more or less confiding public concerning them. In the midst of my meditation and moon-gazing, I was startled by hearing the engine in the Six Works suddenly begin to run. Immediately a queer light, shaped like the beam of a ship's searchlight, but reddish in color, rose high in the moonlit heavens above the mill. It did not last more than a minute or two, for almost instantly the engine was stopped, and with its stoppage the light faded and soon disappeared. The next day Dr. Six gave it out that on starting up his engine in the night something had caught fire, which compelled him immediately to shut down again. The few who had seen the light, with the exception of your humble servant, accepted the doctor's explanation without a question. But I knew there had been no fire, and Six's anxiety to spread the lie led me to believe that he had narrowly escaped giving away a vital secret. I said nothing about my suspicions, but upon inquiry I found out that an extra and pressing order for metal had arrived from the Austrian government the very day of the pretended fire, and I drew the inference that Six, in his haste to fill the order, his supply having been drawn low, had started to work, contrary to his custom, at night, and had immediately found reason to repent his rashness. Of course I connected the strange light with this sudden change of mind. My suspicion having been thus stimulated, and having been directed in a certain way, I began from that moment to notice closely the hours during which the engine labored. At night it was always quiet, except on that one brief occasion. Sometimes it began early in the morning and stopped about noon. At other times the work was done entirely in the afternoon, beginning sometimes as late as 3 or 4 o'clock, and ceasing invariably at sundown. Then again it would start at sunrise and continue the whole day through. For a long time I was unable to account for these eccentricities, and the problem was not rendered much clearer, although a startling suggestiveness was added to it when, at length, I noticed that the periods of activity of the engine had a definite relation to the age of the moon. Then I discovered, with the aid of an almanac, that I could predict the hours when the engine would be busy. At the time of new moon it worked all day. At full moon it was idle. Between full moon and last quarter it labored in the afternoon, the length of its working hours increasing as the quarter was approached. Between last quarter and new moon the hours of work lengthened, until, as I have said, at new moon they lasted all day. Between new moon and the first quarter work began later and later in the forenoon as the quarter was approached, and between first quarter and full moon the laboring hours rapidly shortened, being confined to the latter part of the afternoon, until at full moon complete silence reigned in the mill.
"Well, well," I broke in, greatly astonished by Hall's singular recital. "You must have thought Dr. Six was a cross between an alchemist and an astrologer."
"Note this," said Hall, disregarding my interruption. "The hours when the engine worked were invariably the hours during which the moon was above the horizon."
"What did you infer from that?"
"Of course, I inferred that the moon was directly concerned in the mystery. But how? That bothered me for a long time, but a little light broke into my mind when I picked up, on the mountainside, a dead bird, whose scorched feathers were bronzed with artemisium, and some time later another similar victim of a mysterious form of death. Then came the attack on the mine, and its tragic finish. I have already told you what I observed on that occasion, but instead of helping to clear up the mystery, it rather complicated it for a time. At length, however, I reasoned my way partly out of the difficulty. Certain things which I had noticed in the Six Mill convinced me that there was a part of the building whose existence no visitor suspected, and putting one thing with another, I inferred that the roof must be open above that secret part of the structure, and that, if I could get upon a sufficiently elevated place, I could see something of what was hidden there. Now at last I began to perceive the real truth, but it was so wildly incredible, so infinitely remote from all human experience, that I hardly ventured to formulate it, even in my own secret mind. But I was bound to see the thing through to the end. It occurred to me that I could prove the accuracy of my theory with the aid of a kite. You were kind enough to lend your assistance in that experiment, and it gave me irrefragable evidence of the existence of a shaft of flying atoms extending in a direct line between Dr. Six's pretended mine and the moon."
"Hall," I exclaimed, "you are mad!"
My friend smiled good-naturedly and went on with his story. "The instant the kite shriveled and disappeared, I understood why the works were idle when the moon was not above the horizon. Why birds flying across the fatal beam fell dead upon the rocks, and whence the terrible master of that mysterious mill derived the power of destruction that could wither an army as the Assyrian host in Byron's poem melted like snow in the glance of the Lord. But how did Dr. Six turn the flying atoms against his enemies?" I asked. "In a very simple manner. He had a mirror mounted so that it could be turned in any direction, and would shunt the stream of metallic atoms, heated by their friction with the air, towards any desired point. When the attack came, he raised his machine above the level of the roof and swept the mob to a lustrous, if expensive, death."
"And the light at night?"
"Was the shining of the heated atoms, not luminous enough to be visible in broad day, for which reason the engine never worked at night, and the stream of volatilized artemisium was never set flowing at full moon, when the lunar globe is above the horizon only during the hours of darkness."
"I see," I said, "whence came the nuggets on the mountain. Some of the atoms, owing to the resistance of the air, fell short, and settled in the form of impalpable dust, until the winds and rains collected,
and compacted them in the cracks and crevices of the rocks.
That was it, of course.
And now, I added, my amazement at the success of Hall's experiments and the accuracy of his deductions increasing every moment, do you say that you have also discovered the means employed by Dr. Six to obtain artemisium from the moon?
Not only that, replied my friend, but within the next few minutes I shall have the pleasure of presenting to you a button of moon metal, fresh from the veins of Artemis himself. End of chapter 12.
This recording is in the public domain. The Moon Metal.
Chapter 13.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. The Moon Metal by Garrett P. Service.
Chapter 13. The Looting of the Moon. I shall spare the reader a recital of the tireless efforts, continuing through many almost sleepless weeks, whereby Andrew Hall obtained his clue to Dr. Six's method. It was manifest from the beginning that the agent concerned must be some form of etheric, or so-called electric energy. But how to set it in operation was the problem. Finally, he hit upon the apparatus for his initial experiments, which I have already described. Recurring to what had been done more than half a century ago by Hertz, when he concentrated electric waves upon a focal point by means of a concave mirror, said Hall, I saw that the key I wanted lay in an extension of these experiments. At last I found that I could transform the energy of an engine into undulations of the ether, which, when they had been concentrated upon a metallic object, like a chunk of gold, imparted to it an intense charge of an apparently electric nature. Upon this charging a metallic body enclosed in a vacuum, I observed that the energy imparted to it possessed the remarkable power of disrupting its atoms and projecting them off in straight lines, very much as occurs with a cathode in a Crookes tube. But this was of supreme importance. I found that the line of projection was directly towards the apparatus from which the impulse producing the charge had come. In other words, I could produce two poles between which a marvelous interaction occurred. My transformer, with its concentrating mirror, acted as one pole from which energy was transferred to the other pole, and that other pole immediately flung off atoms of its own substance in the direction of the transformer. But these atoms were stopped by the glass wall of the vacuum tube, and when I tried the experiment with the metal removed from the vacuum and surrounded with air, it failed utterly. This at first completely discouraged me, until I suddenly remembered that the moon is in a vacuum, the great vacuum of interplanetary space, and that it possesses no perceptible atmosphere of its own. At this a great light broke around me, and I shouted, "Eureka!" Without hesitation I constructed a transformer of great power, furnished with a large parabolic mirror to transmit the waves in parallel lines, erected the machinery and building here, and when all was ready for the final experiment I telegraphed for you. Prepared by these explanations, I was all on fire to see the thing tried. Hall was no less eager, and calling in his two faithful assistants to make the final adjustments, he led the way into what he facetiously named the Lunar Chamber. "If we fail," he remarked with a smile that had an element of worriment in it, "it will become the Lunatic Chamber. But no danger of that. You observe this polished silver knob, supported by a metallic rod curved over at the top like a crane. That constitutes the pole from which I propose to transmit the energy to the moon, and upon which I expect the storm of atoms to be centered by reflection from the mirror at which focus it is placed."
"One moment," I said. "Am I to understand that you think that the moon is a solid mass of artemisium, and that no matter where your radiant force strikes it, a cathode pole will be formed there from which atoms will be projected to the earth?"
"No," said Hall, "I must carefully choose the point on the lunar surface where to operate.
But that will present no difficulty. I made up my mind, as soon as I had penetrated Six's secret, that he obtained the metal from those mystic white streaks which radiate from Tycho, and which have puzzled the astronomers ever since the invention of telescopes. I now believe those streaks to be composed of immense veins of the metal that Six has most appropriately named artemisium, which you, of course, recognize as being derived from the name of the Greek goddess of the moon, Artemis, whom the Romans called Diana. But now to work. It was less than a day past the time of new moon, and the Earth's satellite was too near the sun to be visible in broad daylight. Accordingly, the mirror had to be directed by means of knowledge of the moon's place in the sky. Driven by accurate clockwork, it could be depended upon to retain the proper distance when once set. With breathless interest, I watched the proceedings of my friend and his assistants. The strain upon the nerves of all of us was such as could not have been borne for many hours at a stretch. When everything had been adjusted to his satisfaction, Hall stepped back, not without betraying his excitement in flushed cheeks and flashing eyes, and pressed a lever. The powerful engine underneath the floor instantly responded. The experiment was begun. I have set it upon a point about 100 miles north of Tycho, where the Yerkes photographs show a great abundance of the white substance, said Hall. Then we waited. A minute elapsed. A bird, fluttering in the opening above for a second or two, wrenched our strained nerves. Hall's face turned pale. "They had better keep away from here," he whispered with a ghastly smile. 2 minutes. I could hear the beating of my heart. The engine shook the floor. 3 minutes. Hall's face was wet with perspiration. The bird blundered in and startled us again. 4 minutes. We were like statues, with all eyes fixed on the polished ball of silver, which shone in the brilliant light concentrated upon it by the mirror. 5 minutes. The shining ball had become a confused blue, and I violently winked to clear my vision. "At last! Thank God! Look! There it is!" It was Hall who spoke, trembling like an aspen. The silver knob had changed color. What seemed a miniature rainbow surrounded it, with concentric circles of blinding brilliance. Then something dropped, flashing, upon an earthen dish set beneath the ball. Another glittering drop followed, and at a shorter interval another. Almost before a word could be uttered, the drops had coalesced and became a tiny stream, which, as it fell, twisted itself into a bright spiral, gleaming with 100 shifting hues, and forming on the bottom of the dish a glowing, interlacing maze of viscid rings and circlets, which turned and twined about and over one another until they had blended and settled into a button-shaped mass of hot metallic jelly. Hall snatched the dish away and placed another in its stead. "This will be about right for a watch charm when it cools," he said, with a return of his customary self-command. "I promised you the first specimen. I'll catch another for myself." "But can it be possible that we are not dreaming?" I exclaimed. "Do you really believe that this comes from the moon?" "Just as surely as rain comes from the clouds," cried Hall, with all his old impatience. "Haven't I just showed you the whole process?" "Then I congratulate you. You will be as rich as Dr. Six." "Perhaps," was the unperturbed reply, "but not until I have enlarged my apparatus. At present I shall hardly do more than supply mementos to my friends. But since the principle is established, the rest is mere detail." 6 weeks later, the financial centers of the earth were shaken by the news that a new supply of artemisium was being marketed from a mill which had been secretly opened in the Sierras of California. For a time there was almost a panic. If Hall had chosen to do so, he might have precipitated serious trouble. But he immediately entered into negotiations with government representatives, and the inevitable result was that, to preserve the monetary system of the world from upheaval, Dr. Six had to consent that Hall's mill should share equally with his in the production of artemisium.
During the negotiations, the doctor paid a visit to Hall's establishment. The meeting between them was most dramatic. Six tried to blast his rival with a glance, but knowledge is power, and my friend faced his mysterious antagonist, whose deepest secrets he had penetrated, with an unflinching eye. It was remarked that Dr. Six became a changed man from that moment. His masterful air seemed to have deserted him, and it was with something resembling humility that he assented to the arrangement which required him to share his enormous gains with his conqueror. Of course, Hall's success led to an immediate recrudescence of the efforts to extract artemisium from the Six ore, and equally, of course, every such attempt failed. Hall, while keeping his own secret, did all he could to discourage the experiments, but they naturally believed that he must have made the very discovery which was the subject of their dreams, and he could not, without betraying himself and upsetting the finances of the planet, directly undeceive them. The consequence was that fortunes were wasted in hopeless experimentation, and with Hall's achievement dazzling their eyes, the deluded fortune-seekers kept on in the face of endless disappointments and disaster. And presently there came another tragedy. The Six Mill was blown up. The accident, although many people refused to regard it as an accident, and asserted that the doctor himself, in his chagrin, had applied the match. The explosion, then, occurred about sundown, and its effects were awful. The great works, with everything pertaining to them, and every rail that they contained, were blown to atoms. They disappeared as if they had never existed. Even the twin tunnels were involved in the ruin, a vast cavity being left in the mountainside where Six's 10 acres had been. The force of the explosion was so great that the shattered rock was reduced to dust. To this fact was owing the escape of the troops camped near. While the mountain was shaken to its core, the enormous parapets of living rock were hurled down the precipices of the Teton. No missiles of appreciable size traversed the air, and not a man in the camp was injured. But Jackson's Hole, filled with red dust, looked for days afterwards like the mouth of a tremendous volcano just after an eruption. Dr. Six had been seen entering the mill a few minutes before the catastrophe by a sentinel who was stationed about a quarter of a mile away, and who, although he had felled like an ox by the shock, and had his eyes, ears, and nostrils filled with flying dust, miraculously escaped with his life. After this, a new arrangement was made whereby Andrew Hall became the sole producer of artemisium, and his wealth began to mount by leaps of millions towards the starry heights of the billions. About a year after the explosion of the Six Mill, a strange rumor got about. It came first from Budapest in Hungary, where it was averred several persons of credibility had seen Dr. Max Six. Millions had been familiar with his face and his personal peculiarities through actually meeting him, as well as through photographs and descriptions, and unless there was an intention to deceive, it did not seem possible that a mistake could be made in identification. There surely never was another man who looked just like Dr. Six. And besides, was it not demonstrable that he must have perished in the awful destruction of his mill? Soon after came a report that Dr. Six had been seen again, this time at Ekaterinburg in the Urals. Next, he was said to have paid a visit to Batang in the mountainous district of southwestern China, and finally, according to rumor, he was seen in Sicily, at Nicolosi, among the volcanic pimples on the southern slope of Mount Etna. Next followed something of more curious and more startling interest. A chemist at Budapest, where the first rumors of Six's reappearance had placed the mysterious doctor, announced that he could produce artemisium and proved it, although he kept his process secret. Hardly had the sensation caused by this news partially subsided when a similar report arrived from Ekaterinburg, another from Batang, after that a fourth from Nicolosi. Nobody could fail to notice the coincidence. Wherever the doctor, or was it his ghost, appeared, there shortly afterwards somebody discovered the much-sought secret. After this, Six's apparitions rapidly increased in frequency, followed in each instance by the announcement of another productive artemisium mill. He appeared in Germany, Italy, France, England, and finally at many places in the United States. "It is the old doctor's revenge," said Hall to me one day, trying to smile, although the matter was too serious to be taken humorously. "Yes, it is his revenge, and I must admit that it is complete. The price of artemisium has fallen one half within 6 months. All the efforts we have made to hold back the flood have proved useless. The secret itself is becoming public property. We shall inevitably be overwhelmed with artemisium, just as we were with gold, and the last condition of the financial world will be worse than the first." My friend's gloomy prognostications came near being fulfilled to the letter. 10,000 artemisium mills shot their etheric rays upon the moon, and our unfortunate satellite's metal ribs were stripped by atomic force. Some of the great white rays that had been one of the telescopic wonders of the lunar landscapes disappeared, and the face of the moon, which had remained unchanged before the eyes of the children of Adam from the beginning of their race, now looked as if the blast of a furnace had swept it. At night, on the moonward side, the earth was studded with brilliant spikes, all pointed at the heart of its child in the sky. But the looting of the moon brought disaster to the robber planet. So mad were the efforts to get the precious metal that the surface of our globe was fairly showered with it. Productive fields were, in some cases, almost smothered under a metallic coating. The air was filled with shining dust, until finally famine and pestilence joined hands with financial disaster to punish the grasping world. Then at last the various governments took effective measures to protect themselves and their people. Another combined effort resulted in an international agreement whereby the production of the precious moon metal was once more rigidly controlled. But the existence of a monopoly, such as Dr. Six had so long enjoyed, and in the enjoyment of which Andrew Hall had for a brief period succeeded him, was henceforth rendered impossible. End of chapter 13.
This recording is in the public domain.
The Moon Metal,
Chapter 14.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. The Moon Metal by Garrett P. Service.
Chapter 14. The Last of Dr. Six. Many years after the events last recorded, I sat, at the close of a brilliant autumn day, side by side with my old friend Andrew Hall, on a broad, vine-shaded piazza which faced the east, where the full moon was just rising above the rim of the Sierra, and replacing the rosy counterglow of sunset with its silvery radiance. The sight was calculated to carry the minds of both back to the events of former years, but I noticed that Hall quickly changed the position of his chair and sat down again with his back to the rising moon. He had managed to save some millions from the wreck of his vast fortune when artemisium started to go to the dogs, and I was now paying him one of my annual visits at his palatial home in California. "Did I ever tell you of my last trip to the Teton?" he asked, as I continued to gaze contemplatively at the broad lunar disk, which slowly detached itself from the horizon and began to swim in the clear evening sky. "No," I replied, "but I should like to hear about it." "Or of my last sight of Dr. Six?" "Indeed, I did not suppose that you ever saw him after that conference in your mill, when he had to surrender half of the world to you." "Once only I saw him again," said Hall, with a peculiar intonation. "Pray go ahead and tell me the whole story." My friend lighted a fresh cigar, tipped his chair into a more comfortable position, and began. "It was about 7 years ago. I had long felt an inconquerable desire to have another look at the Teton, and the scenes amid which so many strange events in my life had occurred. I thought of sending for you to go with me, but I knew you were abroad much of your time,
and I could not be certain of catching you. Finally, I decided to go alone. I traveled on horseback by way of the Snake River Canyon and arrived early one morning in Jackson's Hole. I can tell you it was a gloomy place, as barren and deserted as some of those Arabian wadies that you have been describing to me. The railroad had long ago been abandoned, and the site of the military camp could scarcely be recognized. An immense cavity with ragged walls showed where Dr. Six's mill used to send up its plume of black smoke. As I stared up at the gaunt form of the Teton, whose beetling precipices had been smashed and split by the great explosion, I was seized with a resistless impulse to climb it. I thought I should like to peer off again from that pinnacle which had once formed so fateful a watchtower for me. Turning my horse loose to graze in the grassy river bottom, and carrying my rope tether along as a possible aid in climbing, I set out for the ascent. I knew I could not get up the precipices on the eastern side, which we were able to master with the aid of our balloon, and so I bore around when I reached the steepest cliffs, until I was on the southwestern side of the peak, where the climbing was easier. But it took me a long time, and I did not reach the rift in the summit until just before sundown. Knowing that it would be impossible for me to descend at night, I bethought me of the enclosure of rocks supposed to have been made by Indians on the western pinnacle, and decided that I would pass the night there. The perpendicular buttress forming the easternmost and highest point of the Teton's head would have baffled me but for the fact that I found a long crack, probably an effect of the tremendous explosion, extending from bottom to top of the rock. Driving my toes and fingers into this rift, I managed with a good deal of trouble and no little peril to reach the top. As I lifted myself over the edge and rose to my feet, imagine my amazement at seeing Dr. Six standing within arm's length of me. My breath seemed pent in my lungs, and I could not even utter the exclamation that rose to my lips. It was like meeting a ghost. Notwithstanding the many reports of his having been seen in various parts of the world, it had always been my conviction that he had perished in the explosion. Yet there he stood in the twilight, for the sun was hidden by the time I reached the summit, his tall form erect and his black eyes gleaming under the heavy brows as he fixed them sternly upon my face. You know, I never was given to losing my nerve, but I am afraid I lost it on that occasion. Again and again I strove to speak, but it was impossible to move my tongue. So powerless seemed my lungs that I wondered how I could continue breathing. The doctor remained silent, but his curious smile, which, as you know, was a thing of terror to most people, overspread his black-rimmed face, and was broad enough to reveal the gleam of his teeth. I felt that he was looking me through and through. The sensation was as if he had transfixed me with an ice-cold blade. There was a gleam of devilish pleasure in his eyes, as though my evident suffering was a delight to him and a gratification of his vengeance. At length I succeeded in overcoming the feeling which oppressed me, and making a step forward, I shouted in a strained voice, "You black Satan!" I cannot clearly explain the psychological process which led me to utter those words. I had never entertained any enmity towards Dr. Six, although I had always regarded him as a heartless person, who had purposely led thousands to their ruin for his selfish gain. But I knew that he could not help hating me, and I felt now that, in some inexplicable manner, a struggle, not physical but spiritual, was taking place between us, and my exclamation, uttered with surprising intensity, produced upon me, and apparently upon him, the effect of a desperate sword thrust which attains its mark. Immediately the doctor's form seemed to recede, as if he had passed the verge of the precipice behind him. At the same time it became dim, and then dimmer, until only the dark outlines, and particularly the jet-black eyes glaring fiercely, remained visible. And still he receded, as though floating in the air, which was now silvered with the evening light, until he appeared to cross the immense atmospheric gulf over Jackson Hole and paused on the rim of the horizon in the east. Then suddenly I became aware that the full moon had risen at the very place on the distant mountain brow where the spectre rested, and as I continued to gaze, as if entranced,
The face and figure of the doctor seemed slowly to frame themselves within the lunar disk, until at last he appeared to have quitted the air and the earth, and to be frowning at me from the circle of the moon. While Hall was pronouncing his closing words, I had begun to stare at the moon, with swiftly increasing interest, until, as his voice stopped, I exclaimed, "Why, there he is now! Funny, I never noticed it before! There's Dr. Six's face in the moon, as plain as day!"
"Yes," replied Hall without turning round, "and I never like to look at it."
End of chapter 14. End of The Moon Medal by Garrett P. Service.
This recording is in the public domain.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.